Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
At the risk of sounding monomaniacal about the subject, I'm going to continue talking about the warfare state because, as James Madison pointed out, and I never tire of repeating, you cannot understand the vile and suffocating growth of government unless you understand how war is used by government to abet its own growth at the expense of those of us who are productive. And that takes us really into a discussion of one of the principles I constantly harp about in my writing and also in the conversations I have with my children. That is that there are only two ways that you can get something in this world. You can get something through cooperation, or you can get something through compulsion. Now, cooperation, of course, means charity. It means generosity. It means, more frequently, mutually beneficial commerce. Whether you're talking about paying to get something from somebody or paying to receive a benefit or a service from somebody, whether you're talking about it as a merchant, a purchaser, an employer, or a laborer, that's peaceful cooperation. The other alternative is coercion. And in that heading, I would include coercion by deception. The conscious effort to take something from somebody without some kind of an equitable consideration would be a form of coercion, short-circuiting the will, the agency, if you will, of the other person is a form of coercion, whether that's done through strong-arm tactics or through misdirection and deception. I would consider it to be a form of coercion. But those are the only two ways you can get something. What government specializes in is coercion, because government is not contemplation. It is not deliberation. It is not eloquence. It is force. That's something that was said by the authors of Cato's letters in the early 18th century in Great Britain. It's a saying which has been attributed to George Washington by, I believe, the earliest source would be H.L. Mencken's Book of Quotations. I've never been able to find a primary source for that widely attributed saying of George Washington, but it's the sort of thing he would say. He did talk about government being like fire, that it can burn as well as provide warmth. But I've never been able to find a primary source for Washington saying the government is not reason, not eloquence, it is force. Like fire, it is a fearful servant and a useful servant and a fearful master. But government, digested to its evil essentials, is the praxis of force. And that's what war is. War is an effort to nullify human beings. It is an effort to destroy, to end everything in this realm, in any case, that a human being is, that he has experienced, the potential that he has in terms of making useful additions to the stock of human welfare. That's what war is all about. It is the ultima ratio regis. It is the last argument of the tyrant. That is why war is so singularly useful to government, and why government itself is a form of institutional warfare. That's the only way you can look at it. At any time we find ourselves being told about the imperative necessity of supporting the government's war on X, what we're being told is that we have to support the material enrichment and aggrandizement of that entity which is at war with us. Anytime you have war as a government program, the result will be a net subtraction from the liberty that you currently enjoy. Oh yes, we'll be told, the alternative is far, far worse. But as I pointed out by quoting this wonderful essay by Justin Logan in the last hour, the way that our Republican, small r Republican, forebears calculated danger was far different. They understood that the greatest danger is that represented by the government ruling us, not by the distant threats that it invokes to justify assuming more power over us, and that the greatest evil was that which is done rather than that which is supposedly prevented. Now, having that as a prologue, I want to share with you this essay by Paul Farrell, who is both a PhD and a JD. That is to say, he's both a doctor and a lawyer. I don't know if he's a medical doctor. I know a couple of people who are both doctors and lawyers. America's Outrageous War Economy is the title of Paul Farrell's piece. Yes, we love war, even when the Pentagon can't find $2.3 trillion, keeps wasting trillions more on national defense. Yes, America's economy is a war economy, not a manufacturing economy, not an agricultural economy, not a service economy, not even a consumer economy. Seriously, I looked into your eyes, America, saw deep into your soul. So let's get honest and officially call it America's outrageous war economy. We spend over half of our tax dollars on war. So admit it, we love our war economy. And that's the answer to Jim Grant's thought-provoking question in the journal, Why No Outrage? There really is only one answer. Deep inside, we love war. We want war, need it, relish it, thrive on war. War is in our genes, deep in our DNA. War excites our economic brain. War drives our entrepreneurial spirit. War thrills the American soul. Oh, just admit it. We have a love affair with war. We love America's outrageous war economy. That's the only rational, honest answer. Americans passively zone out playing video war games. We nod at 90-second news clips of Afghan war casualties and collateral damage in Baghdad. We laugh at Jon Stewart's dark comedic news and Ben Stiller's new war spoof Tropic Thunder that came out a couple of years ago, by the way. All the while, silently by default, we're cheering on our leaders as they aggressively expand America's outrageous war economy, a relentless machine that needs a steady diet of war after war, feeding on itself, consuming our values, always on the edge of self-destruction. Yes, there is no outrage. Why? Admit it, because we secretly love war. Why else are Americans so eager and willing to surrender 54% of our tax dollars to a war machine which consumes 47% of the world's total military budgets? Why are there more civilian mercenaries working for no-bid private war contractors than the total number of enlisted military in Iraq at the time that was 180,000 contractors to 160,000 military personnel? At an added cost to taxpayers in excess of $200 billion and climbing daily. Why do we shake our collective heads yes when our commander-in-chief, by the way, there is no such office in the Constitution, that's a function, one facet of the office of the president. Commander-in-chief is not his title, that describes one function. When our commander-in-chief proudly tells us he is a war president, and his party's presidential candidate chants bomb, bomb, bomb Iran as if war is a celebrity hit song, why do our spineless Democrats let an incompetent, blundering executive branch hide hundreds of billions of war costs in sneaky supplemental appropriations that are more crooked than Enron's off-the-balance sheet deals? By the way, that's happening now under the Nobel Peace Prize winner, the Mahatma Obama, peace be upon him. It's the same corrupt game. Why have Washington's 537 elected leaders turned the governance of the American economy over to 42,000 greedy self-interest lobbyists? And why, earlier this year, this was a couple of years ago, did our Support the Troops war president resist a new GI Bill because, as he said, his military might quit and go to college rather than re-enlist in his war? Now we continue paying the Pentagon's warriors huge $100,000 plus bonuses to re-up so they can keep expanding as America's outrageous war economy. Why? Because we secretly love war. Truth is, we've lost our moral compass. The contrast between today's leaders and the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence in 1776 shocks our conscience. Today's war greed trumps morals. During the Revolutionary War, our leaders risked their lives and fortunes. Many lost both. Today, it's the opposite. Too often, our leaders' main goal is not public service, but a ticket to building a personal fortune in the new outrageous war economy, often by simply becoming a high-priced lobbyist. That's the same game that's been going on for over a century, by the way. K Street, as James Bradley points out in his book, The Imperial Cruise, rather, K Street in the 1890s was notorious as the avenue that provided business lodgings for prostitutes. That's not changed. The difference is in the 1890s, the prostitutes who were habitués of K Street were more honest. They were merely selling themselves. They weren't selling out their country the way that the corporate lobbyist prostitutes of K Street do today. Again, ask yourself, why no outrage? How did we become such wimps? In particular, why are 95 million investors silently watching from a distance? Why are we like sheep, passively surrendering our morals as Washington spends trillions of our tax dollars to expand America's outrageous war economy? Why are we no longer a democracy? We're never supposed to be a democracy, by the way. But a plutocracy of wimps kowtowing to the wealthy elite running our nation from the shadows. We were warned decades ago about the military-industrial complex. Today's new war president is doing exactly the opposite, transforming our lethal military-industrial complex into America's outrageous war economy. Well, the fault is not in our czars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings, I would say. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number, and we will be right back. Just as the practice of diplomacy is best described as an effort to cultivate problems to justify authoritarian solutions, I suppose the purpose of politics is to abet misunderstandings rather than to clear them up peaceably. It's to promote coercive solutions as opposed to promoting cooperative solutions. Now, that really is the axis of conflict between individualists, if you want to call us libertarians or agorists or anarchists, however you want to characterize that perspective, and statists of any hue or variety, is that we believe that conflicts and problems and misunderstandings should be solved cooperatively when at all possible, rather than being transmuted into excuses for amplifying the coercive sector, which is all government is. Now, there is a place, there's a time, there is a role for coercion, defensive coercion, genuine defensive coercion, protecting yourself, your property, your family from aggression. But that's the only circumstance in which it is proper to use coercive force of any kind, let alone lethal force. Now, may God grant that I end my days without being directly involved in taking a human life. Unfortunately, by virtue of living where I do and when I do, and by virtue of the fact that I am a tax victim, I am implicated in the crimes committed by the government presuming to rule me when it comes to the criminal act of taking human lives. And that is something that genuinely torments me. That's one of the reasons, I suppose, why I'm so passionate about this subject. Another reason why I'm so passionate about it, and this is something I've adverted to before, is the fact that I am the father of six children, four sons, two daughters. Just a couple of weeks ago, Charles Rangel, who really, at age 80, has no excuse to be polluting the precincts of Congress anymore, he really should be doing something more worthwhile, reintroduced a bill for full-spectrum coercion in the form of conscription. That's a 100% tax, if you will. 18 to 42 years old, every American under Rangel's bill would be required to be involved in what's called national service. Well, that, of course, that's a dishonest euphemism. Anytime somebody does something worthwhile for another person, that's a service. Anytime you flip a hamburger, anytime you sell something, you put in a day's work in exchange for a salary, you're performing public service. It's not government licensed service necessarily. It's not government approved service. It doesn't bear the imprimatur of the state, but it is service nonetheless. But you see, that doesn't count because it's missing the magic ingredient that makes government ordained service superior to private enterprise, and that magical ingredient is coercion. That's the mysterious quantity that elevates what government mandates above what those of us in the productive realm do with our lives. So Mr. Rangel and people of his kidney believe that it is appropriate to enact, I believe it's the 10th plank of the Communist Manifesto, by creating a system, seamlessly integrated system of national service that would include a military draft. Now, last hour we were talking about the French Revolution. I mentioned the fact that in 1793, the government in Paris dispatched a number of press gangs into the French countryside. And in a little village, the name of which eludes me at the moment, in a department called Le Vendée because of a river nearby, there was a rebellion against these press gangs who were going to conscript the local young men, including married men, into the armies of a pagan regime to fight a war of aggression against other Catholic kingdoms in Europe. And these peasants with pitchforks and pikes, with rakes, hoes, bludgeons, shovels, anything that they had at hand, drove the press gang out of their village. That was defensive violence. It may have been overdone. It's difficult when you're dealing with armed agents of state coercion to calibrate your response precisely. But they were defending their sons, their brothers, their husbands, their fathers from a government that sought to conscript them, thereby stealing everything that they are in the service of a government they didn't support. And that's the sort of situation I see occurring once again in this country, as the government absorbs everything by way of capital that exists in this country, as it continues to absorb all the productive functions, what few are left. I can see a circumstance arising in which there will be a constituency for some kind of a public works project of the sort that Charles Rangel's proposing, not a works progress administration, as in the days of America's first fascist dictator for life, FDR, but something more comprehensive. And what they're talking about is a program wherein, at age 18, every American, male, female, or other, would be required to serve at least 2 years in the federal service, or as many years as the federal service would require. Ah, there's another paraphrase. To answer the trivia question, for those of you who are on tenterhooks to learn, the movie I alluded to earlier, it was Clear and Present Danger. How can I be clear about something? How can I be clear when clarity is precisely what he's trying to avoid, is the line that I was referring to. This idea of spending 2 years or as many years in the federal service as would be required, that's a rough paraphrase of the enlistment oath for the federal service in the film version of Starship Troopers. Maybe I was a little slow on the uptake. People seem to think that Verhoeven's version of Starship Troopers, which came out, if I remember correctly, in 1997, was a satire. I'm not sure that's true, but go with it. Let's assume it was a satire. It still wasn't as good as the novel by Robert Heinlein. But in that future, there was a world federation that claimed the right to extract 2 years' service, or as many years as the government would require, as a condition of being recognized as a citizen rather than a subject. And I can see us slouching, if not sprinting, in that direction very soon, because there's just not going to be anything left in the economy to generate work. And so perhaps people would rationalize this as a type of opportunity for youngsters who otherwise might not have any economic opportunity, because the government has bogarted all the capital out of our economy. If we end up in a war with Iran, and it seems as if the demented people in Washington and London and a couple of other places are just insane enough to do this, then perhaps we'll have an irresistible tropism towards some kind of renewed conscription disguised as a public works project. A few years ago, a friend of mine by the name of Ann Williamson, who now lives in London, she got out of the country at the beginning of the decade. I don't know if London's a superior place to go if you're looking for freedom and security, but she wrote an essay talking about a grand bargain. At some point, she said, foreign investors are no longer going to be willing to sustain America's debt. They're going to want something by way of collateral. And the collateral they're going to require will be us. And you'll have full-blown, undisguised communism of a feudalist variety that would include not merely people 18 to 42, but people from age 8 to 80. Would not only have mandatory service for people in the military of suitable age, but people in their adult years would be forced to work in positions defined by the government pursuant to agreements reached with the creditors, the people who hold the paper on the debts run up by our government. We would literally be the feudal serfs who are the fully owned possession of whoever it is who's acting on behalf of the people holding the paper on our government's debts. She projected that as a possibility, perhaps in the next decade or so. The rate things are disintegrating in this country, it wouldn't surprise me to see that sometime on the other side of 2020 would have a system of that sort. That's one of those I wake up screaming scenarios. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 is our call-in number on the Liberty News Radio Network. Stand by for further flights of rhetorical excess on the other side of this break. We'll be back in just a minute.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
1-866-986-6397 is our call-in number. 1-866-986-6397 is our call-in number. My blog, Pro Libertate, the blog, is found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. For those of you who are interested and have the means, there is a PayPal button you can use to make donations to Pro Libertate, the blog. I'm like the proverbial piano player who's playing for tips, or the fellow with the open guitar case playing on the street corner. Things don't pick up on the employment front. That actually might be a career option for me. It's amazing to me how little it takes, and I've commented about this before, to find oneself on the receiving end of potentially lethal violence by the costumed agents of official coercion. This is a story from Washington, Pennsylvania. Tasers are supposed to be used on those who endanger law enforcement officers or others during a crime or in the process of an arrest, but that's not what happened to Philip Chappell. Mr. Chappell was not a danger or threat to the trooper. He was not a danger or threat to himself, and he was not a danger or threat to anyone else. Philip Fabiano, Chappell's attorney, said he was simply sleeping. Fabiano says Chappell was in the back seat of a yellow cab, having decided to call a cab driver after drinking too much at a Steelers exhibition game in August of 2008. He made what I think most people would agree was the responsible decision not to get behind the wheel, Fabiano said. Instead, 29-year-old Chappell and a buddy took a cab from Heinz Field to Washington, Pennsylvania. When they fell asleep in the back and the driver couldn't wake them, the cabbie took them to the state police barracks in Washington. Oh, boy. This, by the way, illustrates another real problem, and that is that people have been acculturated to seek state intervention in situations where there's no threat to life, liberty, or property. From the time that we are young enough to be treated as malleable material by the people who presume to be our rulers, our minds have been molded, and we've taken the impress of statism. And some of us take a lifetime to try to get rid of it. I find myself irresistibly tempted to refer to Jerry Fletcher from Conspiracy Theory. In the schools, they Betty Crocker all the girls, and they Baden Powell all the boys. Actually, it's the other way around. They Baden Powell all the boys, they Betty Crocker all the girls, and stick them in the Easy Bake Oven. Well, that's exactly what happens in most cases. And quite frankly, the state couldn't be doing what it does to us without our active involvement in these atrocities, both foreign and domestic. The state is what we permit it to be. The state is what we make it. Once again, the fault is not in our czars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. So this cabbie very thoughtfully took these young men to a state police barracks. There's no crime going on here. So why are you asking for the intervention of armed strangers in government-issued costumes? Well, that's what you're supposed to do as a dutiful little citizen. According to a federal lawsuit filed by Chappell, that's where Trooper Jeffrey Agrodsky... Oh, good grief. Ogrodowski used a taser on Chapel in the backseat of the cab and forcibly removed him. A police complaint filed against Chapel at the time says that Chapel apparently in a drunken sleep tried to shush the trooper away. He shushed and made a hand movement, and that was it, and fell back to sleep, Fabiano said. That's when Ogrodowski used the taser on Chapel, who has a heart pacemaker. Mr. Chapel has had a heart pacemaker implanted in his chest since he was 13 months old, Fabiano said. He says tasers may be justified in some situations, but hardly in this one. In this case, Mr. Chapel was asleep. While Chapel says he suffered chest pains after the tasing, his lawsuit alleges a number of other injuries and violations of his free speech and civil rights. Chapel paid a fine for public drunkenness. By the way, he was not drunk in public. And being drunk in public is not a crime. It's not an offense against person or property. It can't really be considered a crime against public order. By the way, I think there is no such thing as a crime against public order. That's a discussion for a different time. But the important point here is that this guy wasn't in public. He was in the back seat of a car. He had called a cab to take him home. And he was tasered because he was sleepy. A local magistrate threw out the trooper's claim that Chapel engaged in disorderly conduct. A jury will decide if the trooper went too far in tasing and what, if any, compensation Chapel should get. He was tasered because he was asleep and he didn't want to be disturbed in his sleep. If you put portable instruments of electroshock torture in the hands of people who are inclined to exercise coercion over others, they will find an excuse to use them. If you give it to them, they will use it. Here's another really good example. This is the sort of thing, by the way, that illustrates why the SB 1070 law in Arizona is fundamentally flawed. This is from, oh, good grief, what town in Florida is it from? Let me read it. This was actually from AOL News. A Central Florida woman who was arrested after her shirt got wet at a kiddie splash park in Tavares. I assume it's Tavares, Florida, and not the mid-1970s family vocal group of the same name, is suing the city for violating her rights, the woman's attorney told AOL News. We are trying to vindicate her and establish that what was done to her was unconstitutional and wrong, said civil rights attorney Howard S. Marks. The incident that provoked the lawsuit occurred in April when Janet Lovett and her husband took their 7-year-old son, who was autistic, to the children's splash park in Tavares. While she was in the park, Lovett was splashed by water. That sort of thing happens in a water park, which soaked the front of her white T-shirt and made her padded bra visible. Janet Lovett's lawyer said the Florida woman is suing the city of Tavares for violating her rights because she was arrested after her shirt got wet. She was ultimately approached by an individual who professed to be a city employee and told her that she was not appropriately dressed for the park, Mark said. He told her she would have to change into a bathing suit or some other clothing. Mark said his client left her husband with their child, put a towel over her shoulders, and walked out of the city-owned park. She was planning on going home to get a bathing suit when she was approached in the parking lot by a police officer. The police officer confronted her and started essentially quizzing her and demanding information from her, stating that she needed to put Mrs. Lovett's name in a database. Mark said, no, she didn't. And the she in this case refers to the she police. No, they didn't need that information in a database. There was no reason to take that information. Lovett, a Peruvian native who was granted American citizenship in January, remember that, Peruvian native granted American citizenship in January, speaks English, albeit not perfectly, Mark said. She said she explained the situation to the officer and requested to speak with her husband. The officer allegedly denied that request and asked Lovett to produce her identification, which the officer had no right to do. She had none with her and told the officer it was in the car. I started shaking. I felt nervous. My son was inside the park with my husband. I was alone, Lovett said in an interview with ABC affiliate WFTV. I was very scared. I had never been arrested before. A police report obtained by WFTV indicates Lovett did not give her name fast enough. As a result, she was taken into custody on suspicion of obstructing justice and resisting arrest. Resisting arrest is not a crime. Resisting arrest is a common law right unless a police officer can demonstrate probable cause. Obstructing justice doesn't play into this if she's simply trying to supply the information the police officer demanded, which the police officer did not have a right to demand. The officer took my client's arms and twisted them behind her back after handcuffing her, Mark said. That caused some bruises to her arms and her hands. She was then escorted into the back of a patrol car and taken to jail. Lovett sat in jail for about 5 hours before her husband could arrange to pay her $1,500 bond, or as I would call it, her ransom money. The state attorney later dropped the charges without explanation. Legally, under the Constitution of the state of Florida and the U.S., it is our position that Mrs. Lovett did not have to provide any identification information, but she never refused to do so, Marks said. Obviously, police have a right to investigate crimes if there is a reason to believe somebody committed a crime, but there was no crime here. Mark said he is also concerned about the city's alleged refusal to disclose information on the database into which the officer allegedly said she wanted to put his client's name. We have never been able to get any answers from the city, Mark said. I don't know what database they could be putting her in. It is either a wet t-shirt database, if the city is maintaining one of those, that's an entirely different story, or an illegal alien database. The city of Tavares acknowledges receiving a notice of intent from Lovett's attorney but declined to comment on the case. Marks said the lawsuit he is filing is for violation of civil rights, false arrest, and malicious prosecution. Well, persecution or prosecution, and I think he's got a slam dunk case on all three of those. He also said that it will ultimately be up to a jury to decide how much money to award his client. Mrs. Lovett committed no crime, Marks said. Absolutely no cleavage was showing. Even if seeing someone's bra is indecent exposure or illegal in the U.S., then we are going to have a lot of appropriations for jails because most of the public is going to be in them. Oh, boy. It takes so little, doesn't it? This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number, and we'll be back in just a minute. So here's this woman who was born in Peru, which is a country that is like pretty much every country in Latin America, oscillating between violent revolutionary insurgency and authoritarian political dictatorship. She comes to the United States. She becomes a U.S. citizen earlier this year. She's with her husband and seven-year-old son at a water park in Florida. She gets wet. She wraps a towel around her shirt, goes back to the car to obtain a swimsuit because she's told by a park employee that because her shirt is wet and her underwear is visible in outline through her shirt, she's not dressed appropriately. She goes back to her car to obtain a swimsuit. Before she can get there, she's accosted by some she police who tells her that she's going to need to cough up ID. Why is she going to have to cough up ID? Because she's brown and speaks English with a Latino accent. That was the so-called justification for a stop that resulted in her being arrested, which is to say abducted under the color of supposed authority, and abused and incarcerated and terrorized. It's because somebody was doing in Florida the same kind of thing that 1070 in Arizona would mandate. They were exploiting a contrived opportunity to demand basically citizenship papers from somebody suspected of being an illegal immigrant who had done nothing by way of committing a crime or committing some act that undermined public morality or public order. It was opportunistic exercise of coercive authority on the basis of this person's apparent identity as an illegal alien. She was a U.S. citizen. She had come here legally. She had obtained citizenship, which is not an easy thing to do. And still, she ended up being abducted, abused, and terrorized. Now, that in a nutshell is why I've got problems with what's going on in Arizona with SB 1070. Why I think it's a bad idea. That and the fact that there is this database issue that popped up in the story. What is this database? What is this information you're trying to wring at gunpoint from people? What are you going to do with it? Well, as Ernest Hancock, who's another colleague here at the Liberty News Radio Network, has pointed out, SB 1070 is part of the aggregator, if you will, of data that will be stored on a database to be used by the feds when they get around to creating this seamless, integrated real ID system. And this is another really good example, in my opinion, of how people acting on understandable concerns over the immigration issue are being manipulated into supporting the enrichment of the garrison state. If you want to call it a police state, that's a perfectly acceptable expression. Here's another story that I find really quite striking, in that you've got a potent example of what happens when those who dish it out have to dine on what they serve the rest of us. As a prisoner, former U.S. District Judge Samuel B. Kent has been shunted into solitary confinement, forced to hear the screams of another inmate being raped, and ordered by a cruel sergeant in the Florida prison system to do calisthenics in the nude, according to allegations in a federal court memorandum filed Tuesday. Doing calisthenics in the nude, for some reason I'm flashing on Die Hard 2, the villain liked to exercise in the nude. Oh, my eyes. Kent has requested that his 33-month sentence be vacated and adjusted based on his allegations of inhumane and unfair treatment. The former Galveston-based federal judge, oh boy, he's from Texas. Texas judges are not noted for their leniency, was impeached by Congress and resigned in June 2009 after being convicted of obstruction of justice. He admitted in a related plea deal that he lied about having repeated unwelcome sexual contact with two female court employees. In legal action this week, Kent argues he has been unjustly labeled a sex offender by the Federal Bureau of Prisons and wrongfully excluded from a substance abuse treatment program that could have reduced his sentence by as much as a year. The court filings argue that U.S. District Judge Roger Vinson, a senior judge from Florida, also believed Kent would be treated more fairly and would qualify for the program at the time of sentencing. Instead, Kent says he has been transferred from prison to prison without explanation, at times prevented from communicating his whereabouts with his wife or his attorney, and forced to spend long stints in solitary, once for 43 consecutive days. He's now assigned to an unnamed maximum security facility in the Florida state prison system, where the alleged mistreatment only worsened. Kent's attorney, Dick DeGuerin, I believe Dick DeGuerin was involved in representing, if I'm not mistaken, didn't Dick DeGuerin represent some of the Branch Davidians in Waco? Let's see here. The Bureau of Prisons inmate website doesn't disclose Kent's current location. DeGuerin likened Kent's treatment to torture. Attorneys for both of Kent's victims had no immediate comment on the judge's request for reconsideration of his sentence. In the criminal prosecution and in congressional testimony, Kent was accused of repeatedly groping his former case manager both on and under her clothing, and once attempting to force her to perform a sex act I'm not going to specify. He also was accused of forcing caresses on his secretary and performing unwanted... Oh, for heaven's sake, I'm not going to read that phrase either. Suffice it to say, by way of summary, family-friendly summary, he's not a nice guy. In court papers, Kent alleges his mistreatment as a prisoner began in June 2009, the very day he resigned as a judge. At that time, Kent was assigned to the Devon Federal Prison, a medical evaluation facility in the U.S. Bureau of Prison System in Massachusetts. Kent resigned days after becoming the 14th judge in U.S. history to be impeached by a vote of the U.S. House of Representatives. He's a federal judge, remember. The resignation allowed him to avoid removal from the bench through a full U.S. Senate trial. That day, BOP staff locked Kent, quote, wearing only a smock and carrying only a single sheet in a filthy, completely empty cell where the temperature was kept at 60 degrees. The only bed in the room was a raised concrete slab with no mattress, and the light was kept on constantly, Kent's motion to vacate his sentence says. After being evaluated at Devon, Kent had expected to be transferred to a facility where he could receive treatment for alcohol abuse and depression, documents say. Instead, he ended up at the Lake Butler Reception Center in Florida's Department of Corrections. There, an unidentified sergeant forced Kent to strip naked and perform a painful and repetitive series of humiliating exercises. Once Sam Kent was too tired and in too much pain to perform the exercises anymore, the sergeant confiscated Sam Kent's wedding ring and used it to ridicule him, the records say. By the way, that's entirely plausible. What do you think the people from Abu Ghraib got the instruction? Where were they given their tutorial in the casual abuse of prisoners? These are people who work in U.S. prisons. They work in our archipelago of detention centers for people who have not, for the most part, committed crimes against persons and property. I'm not sure you can make a case that Samuel Kent should receive some kind of clemency or some kind of an adjustment of a sentence. I'd like to see him make restitution of some sort rather than spend time behind bars in prison. I would be interested to find out how many people he sent to prison as sex offenders, how many people he sentenced to prison as drug abusers, as people who were using drugs, not necessarily conducting a commerce in them, but simply using them. That being said, I don't want to see any human being treated this way, but it's entirely believable, the account that he provides here. Kent spent the next 16 days in solitary, where he claims the first night he helplessly listened to the continuous screams of a man being violently raped in the next cell, and was horrified to observe that the guards ignored the man's screams and only came to remove the man from the cell after the attack had finally ended. Boy, we had an incident like that here at one of these corporate-run prisons in Boise. This is very, very commonplace. We have the largest prison population in the world. It shouldn't surprise us to learn that this sort of thing takes place. Kent has participated in alcohol treatment in the Florida State Prison, court papers say, but such abusive psychological and physical conditions have jeopardized his ongoing recovery from severe depression and alcoholism. DeGuerin says Kent decided to appeal to the federal courts for relief after other informal complaints brought no real improvement. DeGuerin said Tuesday he hopes Judge Vinson will grant a hearing to review evidence to support Kent's motion for the reconsideration of his sentence. Now, I would be more inclined to credit his sincerity if Mr. Kent were to be involved in canvassing other inmates regarding their circumstances. If Kent would be making some kind of an effort to inquire into the treatment of people he sent to prison. But this, once again, I think, is an application of what appears to be an inexhaustibly relevant political maxim. The chief question in politics is who does what to whom. That's Lenin's satanic inversion of the Golden Rule, which, of course, is do unto others as you would be done to. He's on the receiving end now. He's a catcher rather than a pitcher. He is the whom rather than the who. He doesn't like it a whole lot. Chances are there are a lot of people he sent to prison who are treated much worse than he's being treated. I want to know if he's ever, in the course of his imprisonment, had an honest moment of reckoning within his own soul regarding what he has done to other human beings under the color of supposed authority. Something to think about. Hey, have a great Lord's Day tomorrow. Join me again next week for another installment of Pro Libertate, the radio program on the Liberty News Radio Network. This program and all other programs on this network are available in the archive section at libertynewsradio.com. My blog, Pro Libertate, is accessible at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'll be with you again next week, and until then, as always, dum spero bugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, and God bless.